Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, November 7th, the day of the election. We had historic news here in terms of the election of Tammy Baldwin to the U.S. Senate in the state of Wisconsin, the first female to be elected to the Senate and the first openly gay person to be elected. And she made reference to both of those in her victory speech last night, saying that she ran to make a difference, and so her work begins. And Tommy Thompson, who served this state as governor for a long time and was Secretary of Health and Human Services, indicated last night that that would be the end of his running for office, and we're going to be talking about that race. Also look at this makeup of the state of Wisconsin, which I can't quite figure out. You have a conservative governor, and you have a very progressive senator who was just elected. So what's it all about? We have several guests with us looking not only at Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio Milwaukee reporter, is joining us the first part of the show. Ohio got kind of messy last night, didn't it? We'll be looking at what happened in Ohio, and indeed it did become the state, I believe, that put the president over the top, but then it was contested by Karl Rove and others, and so we'll talk about that with Brian Bull, reporter-producer for Northeast Ohio Public Radio, and later in this hour, Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill. Phone calls should be directed toward that Senate race, this particular part of the show, and the presidential race in the state of Wisconsin, and the makeup of the Wisconsin legislature as well. Chuck Kornbach, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Well, we made history yesterday in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, here and there, yeah.
Here and there. It was a big win for Tammy Baldwin. And would you please explain to me what is with this state? How do you have a state that elects a very progressive woman to the Senate, and you have a very conservative governor in the state? What is it?
Well, I think that Scott Walker won the recall race back in June because there were some Democrats and others that didn't, independents that didn't like the recall process in part, or thought that their taxes were lower or about the same. At the national level, you have to factor in things like Obama had a pretty good lead among Marquette's polling in foreign policy and other issues, that Obama was more viewed as more likable, more interested in us, the middle class or the lower low-income folks. So a lot of factors are at work, but and personality and energy are part of it as well, I think.
This Senate race was so expensive for both candidates, wasn't it? Just a phenomenal amount of money.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of TV stations and maybe newspapers, ads benefited. It's staggering sums. You wonder where, you know, we hear about the long road to recovery and other economic woes, but somebody had money, you know, from the coasts or the oil patch or the cotton fields or, you know, out east to fund these things.
Yeah. You were at Tommy Thompson's concession speech last night?
Well, yes, the victory party, that the only people with a little bit of smile on their face was some Republican state senators because they had regained control of that chamber. But yes, pretty somber mood as the evening went on. Governor Thompson told reporters he didn't really think he was going to lose. I mean, I think a lot of politicians have to have that sort of self-confidence, but Thompson said, listen, I woke up Tuesday morning, I thought I was going to win. Somebody asked him what his plan was for Wednesday. Well, he said, well, my plan was going to be at my transition meeting, but said he's going to, was heading to Elroy, perhaps, to get out on the farm. Thompson did talk at quite at length in a speech, talked with reporters quite a bit. Doesn't really like to step away from the spotlight, but I guess he's going to have to.
Here's a bit of his concession speech from last night.
We want to make sure that our children and grandchildren are going to be able to inherit a country that's stronger and freer and fairer and safer with more opportunities than what we had. And I thought that was slipping away. And I wanted so much to help lead back America.
So what happens to him now? Does he slip away from the political world, Chuck?
Well, I think the Republicans were talking about him, you know, going to him for advice. might go to him for a campaign loan. Thompson is not hurting financially. Be some sort of elder statesperson in the party. He's still very up on issues, still very active. I don't know if a university would offer him anything. He's probably going to remain on some corporate boards and continue to do well for his personally, for his children and grandchildren. Hard to see him totally stepping out of the spotlight as long as he remains in good health. Interesting, I don't know if you have it, but he said both in his remarks and to the reporters last night, very sort of bipartisan words. I mean, there were some in the audience there that somehow Tammy Baldwin's victory speech got put on the TV screens there, and there were some very angry people making comments while her remarks were being broadcast. But Thompson in his remarks said, listen, the president won. He's our president. Tammy Baldwin won. I called and congratulated her. She wasn't my first choice, but, she's our senator. So Tommy has done well in both the government and private sectors. He certainly respects the halls of government, and I thought his sort of bipartisan branch there was sort of an interesting touch.
Yeah, and she made some comments in her speech about his making reference to her father, giving her stories about her father during the times that they would run into each other, and it seemed to be very heartfelt what she was saying.
Well, the culture of the state capitol, where they both were for a couple of years, a few years, there's a lot of warring going on, but there's also some, you're in the same building with people, and at some point you have to get along to a certain degree and be civil. And Thompson, Thompson, I think, was a Democrat early on in parts of his life, or at least embraced some Democratic principles before he turned very sharp to the right. But even as a Republican, I remember him as a U.S. Health Secretary coming to Milwaukee and basically saying, I'm doing what I like to do best is hand out money. Mm-hmm. That didn't, over time isn't sitting well with some members of his party. But certainly as governor, he approved a lot of spending and projects and likes to build and occasionally like to use taxpayers' money to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we were talking about this a little bit yesterday? It's hard for me to remember a time when Tommy Thompson wasn't a prominent force here in the state of Wisconsin, a dominant force. Have we reached a time where people are just getting older and there's a huge chunk of the population that has no idea how dominant he was in Wisconsin politics and national politics for a long time?
Well, that's certainly the case. All of us have relatives that might have voted for Thompson at some point who are no longer with us or able to vote or whatever. There's certainly a graying going on and a younger generation that is not maybe quite in tune with Tommy. But although there were younger people that came up to him last night, there were a string of well-wishers after his speech and before he talked with reporters. And there were young and old alike that came up to him and shook his hand, embraced him, and so on. So he did have some connection with younger folks in sort of a maybe grandfatherly way or standard bearer way, but that leadership now is apparently with the hands of the Ryan and Walker generation of the Republican Party, at least it seems.
Yeah, and we go back to the progressive tradition in the Democratic Party in this state with the election of Tammy Baldwin, who along with Elizabeth Warren will, as a previous guest suggested, be two of the more progressive members of the U.S. Senate.
Well, they will. Baldwin will be low on the seniority poll there in Washington and have to struggle with that, but she will be in the majority party. It'll be interesting to see how much she and the Senate and President Obama try to work together and how much the House of Representatives, as you might expect, would try and slow them down, steer them to a different course, stand in the way. The House is still quite very strong, got stronger, I think, right, Republicans. So Baldwin will find and already knows from governing and
sure.
being in the House minority for a number of years that it's not easy to get things done.
Yeah. And what about the Wisconsin legislature? Do things remain pretty much the same, that it's going to be difficult for Democrats to work with Republicans, or does the re-election of Barack Obama and the election of Tammy Baldwin change things in some ways, Chuck?
Well, it remains to be seen. Governor Walker, had an 8:15 availability this morning that I didn't get to, but I'm sure he'll be available at the Capitol or in the next day or two or somewhere just to say what his plans are. But last night afterwards, he appeared on stage with Thompson, but then left, wasn't available, issued a statement that he looked forward to working with both parties at the Capitol. But there were, as I say, some Republican state senators there last night, sad, but, realizing that in their world they had regained some power. Likely Majority Leader Fitzgerald was there.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are currently experiencing technical difficulties with our feed from Milwaukee out over the network. We are working to correct it, and we'll get back to our Kathleen Dunn program as soon as possible.
take place sometime during the day. What the heck happened with Ohio last night? It was the weirdest thing. We were watching, and all of the networks called Ohio fairly early, and then all of a sudden, we're hearing that the Republicans were contesting the vote. What was the outcome of that?
Kathleen?
What was going on?
Oh, you cut out there briefly, Kathleen. Can you repeat the question again? I'm sorry.
What was going on with contesting the vote in Ohio after all the networks had called the election?
Well, I don't think the Republicans were very comfortable with seeing the tide turning against their chosen presidential candidates and some other related races. And I think when you have a contest that is tight as it was in many key areas, you don't want to basically tip your hat to the other party. And so you saw this manifested especially on Fox News, which was playing in the ballroom of the hotel I was at in Columbus last night, where Fox News essentially called Ohio, I believe, earlier than many other news outlets did. They had their own experts and analysts looking at the numbers and seeing how the demographics were trending across the state. And Karl Rove, who we all remember from the Bush administration being a key strategist, took umbrage with that call and chastised and contested that they shouldn't be calling it as early as they did. But as it turns out, Fox made the correct call, and Ohio went towards Ohio. And within a couple hours, the president was giving his acceptance speech, and Mitt Romney was giving his concession speech.
So when was it determined? What was the behind-the-scenes talking that was going on to change this? Who was talking to who?
I believe that one of the big questions that was raised had to do with the provisional ballots. And I think there was some hope, perhaps, among some who weren't ready to call Ohio just yet, that there were more than 119,000 absentee ballots and more than 205,000 provisional ballots outstanding. And so I believe it was hoped at that point that maybe, just maybe, there could be some case made that the call could be held off while it was examined what these provisional ballots may do. Now, as it turns out, the margin of victory for Obama expanded to the point where Romney's attorneys could not contest the results. And as it turns out, a lot of provisional and absentee ballots, by and large, lean towards Democratic anyway. So I think within the huddle of the backroom huddle, or I guess in the Renaissance Hotel where I was at, it was the third floor where media had no access, a lot of the GOP operatives simply said, it's time now to throw in the towel.
Can you tell us, we seem to know Ohio pretty well now because we've been covering this, all the different areas in Ohio and where the president had to do well, where Governor Romney had to do well. Cuyahoga County, there were reports that maybe the president was not performing as well as he needed to. What happened in that county?
Cuyahoga County did turn out for the president, and I talked to the chair of the Democratic Party just a few days before the election, and he conceded that the output of absentee ballots and provisional ballots and get-out-the-vote grant efforts were hampered and not up to par with what 2008 efforts were.
Whoops, hello. I think we've lost the connection. So we will probably get him on a phone. Brian Bull is our guest this part of the program, and we're going to break down some of the vote in Ohio. We've done several shows on Ohio, and as you well know, several of our guests have said that the auto bailout was really key, and I'm wondering if that indeed was what happened in Ohio, that that's what gave, secured a victory for the president, what inroads Governor Romney may have made that maybe were not detected as people were looking at the vote. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, I know that we're doing different guests on different topics here, so we'll get to your phone calls, and then we're reserving the last part of this hour for just taking as many phone calls as we can. But we'll get to your phone calls. If you can stay on hold, please do so. Our number is 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And we also have this Facebook page, which you can go to, which is a nice thing. You know, we can read what you're thinking after the show. If you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and leave your thoughts about what is what your thoughts are about what happened, how we voted yesterday. A little bit later this hour, Cameron Joseph will be joining us, staff writer for The Hill. We were also interested in what was happening in Florida in terms of early voting there and people in these incredibly long, long lines. And we get news this morning after another election meltdown in Miami. The result of the presidential race in Florida is still uncertain. By dawn, all precincts in the state had finished reporting. The totals gave an edge of more than 46,000 votes for President Obama, which really is only about 0.5%. But a number of counties had not yet counted their absentee ballots. In Miami-Dade, that's the county that really had problems this go-around. Election workers had to count 20,000 absentees. So we'll be looking at Florida, and that will be coming up. So, so let's go to a phone call. Joe in Whitehall is next. Hi, Joe. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I know there's a, I'm an independent and I voted for the president. There's a lot of talk about gridlock and coming up in Congress and all that. And I don't know why the media doesn't talk more about people like Karl Rove and the ones who, when the Republicans get to Washington, some of these guys, they come in and tell them, you've got to sign this pledge, you're not going to raise taxes, or you won't be running for office next time. And I just wonder how come there isn't more spotlight shined on that kind of thing, because a lot of Republicans are just paralyzed, you know, with fear to vote for something that's going to go against this pledge.
Do you think that's going to change now with the second term here or not, Joe? Do you see more of the same?
More of the same. I think, you know, when you get to Washington, you don't want to leave it. You know, keep that job as long as you can, and the only way to do that is to stay there. And if it's some guy that's telling you, you know, sign this pledge or, you know, you're not going to get our help anymore, you're probably going to you're going to fight it. I just don't know if it's going to change a whole lot. I think in the long run it will, because obviously you've got, you know, more liberal people, gay and lesbians getting into office, things like that. But in the short term, I don't see it really changing a lot. But there's a lot of spot on these people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joe, very much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go. We've lost our connection with Brian Bowles, so we're trying to regain it or get somebody to answer a phone call there in Ohio. But there seems to be something wrong with the lines of communication. So we're just taking some of your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Matt is next in Escanaba, Michigan. Hi. Hi, Matt.
Hi, good morning. Having a few connection issues, aren't you?
Yeah, just with this just with this one Ohio, we'll resolve
it. We'll work it out.
We'll work it out, yeah.
The power of public radio.
Right.
Well, listen, I actually have been listening all morning, and I was wondering if there could be a discussion about the compare and the contrast between the Republican presidential campaigns between 2008 and 2012. And the reason it's such an interest to me is because in 2008, being 30 years old right now, that was really when I came into it being a much bigger issue for me, you know, starting a career, buying a house, starting a family and things like that, and paid much more attention to the race in 2008 than in 2004. But what I think the presiding notion in 2008 was that they had, Republicans had an extremely solid candidate with John McCain. And as a voting Democrat, a lot of the other voting Democrats I talked to said that, you know, McCain might not have been a bad choice. They might have even voted for him. It was just that the Palin aspect of it, choosing Governor Palin for the vice presidential candidate, really just took him out of the running. And, you know, in retrospect, I don't want to call it a gimmick to put her on the ballot, but it was like they kept all of their ideals in place except added this X factor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have here in 2012, and that's really what they ran on. I mean, Governor Palin was all over the media, and she was really the masthead for the whole campaign. Then here in 2012, you have Mitt Romney, and really just kind of a boilerplate of Mitt Romney, at least what I saw, was Paul Ryan. And you have the two of them, I don't want to say telling people exactly what they wanted to hear, depending on what room they were in, but I did see that as kind of the presiding notion, and it didn't work, and it didn't work in 2008 either. the strategy that they held. But the difference between 2008 and 2012 was very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, in 2016, you know, with the Latino vote making such an impact, with women voters making such an impact, and with everything else staying more or less the same, you know, is there any kind of speculation that over the next 4 years, are Republicans going to change their model entirely to be more moderate, or are we just going to see another gimmick?
Thanks very much. I think you ask a very interesting question, and a lot of analysts are saying that they can't win more elections nationally unless there is a change in trying to find issues that will appeal to Latino voters. I think that's one of the big things that we've learned in this election, I think. We'll do shows on that. Brian Bull is rejoining us. We're on a phone line now, a reporter-producer for Northeast Ohio Public Radio. Hi, Brian.
Hello again.
Now we're on that regular phone line, and it's working just fine. So tell me, we spent a lot of time talking about the auto bailout and how that issue was crucial for voters, at least in certain parts of Ohio. Was it the key issue?
It was a pivotal issue just about a week and a half before Election Day. Mitt Romney released a series of ads and statements that said that Jeep, which is a major employer here in Ohio, was moving production to China. And this prompted an immediate outcry from Democrats, but they were soon joined by a chorus of auto representatives, auto workers, and people who just simply said, no, this is not correct. And technically, there is Jeep production to be had in China, but it's part of the company's overall expansion, Chrysler. But Chrysler and GM, who did not want to get drawn into the political fracas, had to, essentially, because they were worried about their brand. They were worried about how this was being perceived by everyone from consumers to their brokers and investors to say that, no, this is not correct what the GOP nominee is saying about our jobs. And one out of every job in Ohio is tied to manufacturing, auto manufacturing having a very long legacy here. You have everyone from Chrysler to GM to Honda to you name it, a lot of related industries, vendors, and suppliers are also tied into it. So it looked to be a calculated move at first by the Romney campaign to steal the president's prized auto bailout from his platform and try to usurp it. But as it turns out, the backlash that came about, I think, really got people fired up and angry and willing to take that anger out at the ballot box.
Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty big miscalculation on the part of the Romney campaign.
I think that's fair to say. I think that there are still many people here in Ohio fuming about that.
Yeah. Tell me, you've lived in, you worked for Wisconsin Public Radio for some time. Can you compare the State House and the governor in both states? Is the State House in Ohio Republican now, or is it divided, Brian?
The State House, the legislature here in Ohio, is dominantly Republican, has been for years. It also has a very big party booster in Governor John Kasich. He is a kind of a maverick, kind of an off-the-cuff kind of character. He likes to throw around phrases like wackadoodle when he refers to people in California. He makes remarks about his very charming, voluptuous wife in his State of the State address. He's very, very colorful, I guess. But his standing right now in Ohio is actually much improved over the last year. About a year ago, he had approval ratings down in the 30s, and he had a big bruising setback. He and the legislature had basically pushed through collective bargaining restrictions. And in Ohio, I believe there's the bylaws and provisions are such that it could have been, it was, repealed by a public vote last November, a year ago. So basically, the Republican governor and the legislature enacted collective bargaining restrictions. The voting public came in and said, no, you don't, and threw it right out. And so that was kind of a devastating setback. But as far as the standing goes now, Kasich, he is, again, a perennial partner. He's at the helm of a state that has seen its job numbers greatly improve. In fact, it was kind of interesting to watch the Romney campaign come through Ohio and try to paint this narrative of an economy that was going down the tubes, and it's all underneath the Obama administration. But then you had John Kasich pop in and say, hey, you know, we've restored our manufacturing sector, jobs are coming back. And so it was an Ohio governor whose narrative was at odds with the Republican presidential nominees.
Yeah. Let's go to Renee, take a call for you, Brian, in Shorewood. Hi, Renee.
Yeah, hi. I'm just hoping that now that Obama's been reelected for his second term, that he will now stop playing the diplomat and come out and put the blame where the blame lies in the Republican Congress that has refused categorically to make any concessions whatsoever, to make any kind of progress, because we will not support that Democrat in the White House.
Well, let's phrase this a different way. Brian, what do you think when people voted for President Obama in Ohio, what were they hoping for in terms of a second term?
I think, to echo what the caller listened to, I think they are hoping for a president who can reach across the aisle and work with Republicans, especially in Congress, which has seen a couple years of gridlock, as we all know. At the same time, though, too, I mean, I think there are a number of people who really sign on to the president's platform. The auto bailout won him a lot of fans in Ohio. I think they want to see the president go to bat for industry and growth not only here in the United States but also in other countries. Romney tried to paint the president as very weak on China, for example, but the president was quick to point out, too, that he had filed complaints about the Chinese devaluing their currency and other related practices. So I think they're hoping that the president, Ohioans, I hope they see some progress made in championing industry, manufacturing. The president has also discussed the possibility of fracking, natural gas drilling, with some environmental responsibility. So in some ways that caters to those who favor this form of energy exploration, but at the same time are concerned about some of the environmental consequences. He's talked up wind energy, and there's a number of sections here in Ohio that are looking at developing wind sites. And I think also, too, that there's just a fair number of people who are very concerned about issues of education and health care. And the Affordable Care Act, which was once seen as a potential albatross hung around the president's neck, is now being seen as a safeguard. And one way I think that manifested itself was with Sherrod Brown, a Democratic incumbent senator, defeating challenger and Tea Party favorite Josh Mandel here last night. Sherrod Brown at one point was seen as vulnerable for supporting the Affordable Care Act, but he turned that around to say this is how it's going to benefit Ohioans, and this is how we're going to, you know, make the case that this is something that people need and people will appreciate when it's fully implemented in 2014.
What was the margin in that race, Brian?
There was about a 5-point margin of victory for Sherrod Brown. And this was probably one of the most contentious, nastiest races that I have ever witnessed in good memory. Mandel basically came out. He, on paper, he looked like an ideal candidate. He was a young, aspiring, fast-rising star in the Republican Party. He had served 2 terms in Iraq. He was a Marine veteran. But he kind of caught himself mired in a number of issues early on. PolitiFact, which works with our Cleveland Plain Dealer, basically crowned him the pants-on-fire king in this race. Not to say that Sherrod Brown wasn't caught in a few, but it seemed like Josh Mandel dominated the pants-on-fire rating by PolitiFact for a number of claims. And there are some other people who said that even though they were going to support Romney, they could not bring themselves to support Mandel because the Brown camp had largely painted him as a young, inexperienced, and often ambitious politician. He's held 3 offices in about 7 years, I believe, city councilman, state treasurer. I immediately draw a blank on what his other profession was, but, you know, 3 jobs in 7 years, they said this is a guy who's just leapfrogging through the political system, and the super PACs weighed in. I believe the final price tag was $50 million.
Oh, my gosh.
PAC, making it one of the top 5 expensive Senate races in the U.S.
Oh, unbelievable. Brian, thank you so much for being with us. Hope you get a little nap this afternoon.
A pleasure, Kathleen. I'll
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, nice to hear you in Wisconsin again. Brian Bull, reporter, producer for Northeast Ohio Public Radio. Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill. I'm interested in what's going on in Florida. What votes have yet to be counted? Does it look like the president will eke out a victory there? And why can't they get their elections under control so people don't have to wait in line for hours and hours to vote, for heaven's sake? What's going on there? We'll talk with Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill, in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Cameron Joseph is joining us now, staff writer for The Hill. Let's start our conversation in Florida, where this came from the LA Times this morning. The worst of the problems in terms of voting in Florida were in Miami-Dade, the state's largest county. Long lines began before the polls opened on Tuesday and never let up. When the election was called for Obama, people were still standing in line in dozens of precincts. The last Miami-Dade voter finished just after 1 a.m. Unless I've missed something in the last hour and a half, they're still counting votes, and we're not sure at this point who won Florida. Let's start with Florida with Cameron. Hello, Cameron. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what's going on in Florida?
Well, Florida, right now, Barack Obama is up by about 50,000 votes as of the last count. And that's with 100% of precincts reporting. That doesn't mean all of those precincts have completely reported at this point. And obviously Barack Obama is going to be reelected to a second term one way or the other. But I think that the issue of early voting and the issue of these really, really long lines is a big one. A lot of states, one of the first things they cut when the recession hit and their taxes plunged was these voting booths and money for good voting. Mm. And the combination of that and a national requirement to move to more digital ballots, to more tech-friendly ballots in the last decade really complicated a lot of things. And on top of that, a lot of Republican governors and legislatures were trying to really fight and keep early voting to a minimum because Democrats tend to win in the early vote. And in 2008, Barack Obama racked up huge margins in the early vote. And so Rick Scott, who's the Florida governor, was actively fighting against early voting. And there was a lot of last-minute court decisions. There was a lot of contention down there over this issue. It happened in Ohio as well, although the Secretary of State there was rebuffed by the courts on a lot of these decisions. And Obama won by a comfortable enough margin that it didn't become the same type of issue. But, you know, this is really there's a lot of partisan gamesmanship around the actual holding of the election at this point. And in Florida and Ohio especially, this has been a quadrennial and biennial problem. We saw this in Florida in 2000. We saw this in Ohio in 2004. And this is just something that as long as we continue to have a partisan Secretary of State run the election is going to be an issue no matter who's in power in a few states.
Yeah. Isn't your pride at stake on some basic level that you can't get it right? You had 2000, for heaven's sake. You would think that by 2012 you'd want people in the rest of the country and the world to look at Florida and say, well, they care about this deeply now and they've fixed whatever problems they had.
You would think. Jeb Bush, who was governor there, was really focused on fixing this. Charlie Crist spent some time when he was governor working on fixing this. And Rick Scott, who is really unpopular in his state, spent a ton of money to win and barely pull off a win in 2010 as a Republican. And he's really, a lot of folks don't think he's doing a great job down there. And his approval rating is very poor in the state. And he's come off as hyper-partisan. Even Mitt Romney was mostly avoiding campaigning with him down there. The first rally he was at of Romney's in months was just days before the election, and he wasn't ever put on stage while Romney was on stage. They wanted to avoid that photo op. So there's a reason that he's not beloved in Florida, and it's a big difference from the last two governors who were both very well-liked during their tenures. Both of whom were, at least at the time, Republicans. So, you know, I think that we're going to, you know, Barack Obama mentioned that in the speech last night about how he wants to fix this early voting issue. That this is one of those things that's become a partisan football because Democrats do better in early voting. This used to be more of a bipartisan issue.
Right.
And like in this hyper-polarized climate, Republicans have really moved away from trying to improve early voting, expand early voting, improve absentee ballots. And this whole voter fraud thing, which really there's very little actual evidence of, at least in terms of in-person voter fraud, it has really inflamed the party, and they're really unwilling to do a lot of vote expansion. And because of that, we're going to see, as long as they stick with these policies, are going to see very, very long lines and a lot of voter confusion. On top of that, there was redistricting this year, so a lot of folks had to go to new polling places, and that caused an additional bit of chaos. And so this is just a mess on top of a mess. And as long as we see very high turnout, it's going to be a problem for years to come unless they really do something drastic to fix it.
One of the things I was noticing in watching coverage last night was that the Obama campaign had a strategy, and they knew how to deal with all of these battleground states. They knew how often to go there. They knew how many television ads to run. It seemed to me as though their plan was extremely well executed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you could have seen a much better run campaign. And Obama won the popular vote narrowly. He's up by about 2 million votes nationally, which is, a bigger margin than George W. Bush won in both of his elections, I believe. I have to double-check on that. But, he basically swept all the swing states, and he nearly pulled off a victory in North Carolina. It looks like Florida's going to go for him, and every other swing state he won. And they really focused on a lot of wedge issues that I think that used to be looked at as Republican wedge issues. They focused on social issues, they focused on abortion, they focused on gay rights, they focused on contraception, which really helped them with a lot of more well-educated and younger voters. They really focused on some of the more very, very conservative things that Mitt Romney said about immigration and Hispanics during the primary, and drove up the Hispanic turnout in a few states pretty well. And so we're really looking at a very different demographic coalition. Republicans were expecting this election to look more like 2004 in terms of the demographics of these states. And Obama had probably the best ground game in the history of presidential campaigns, turned out his voters, and their messaging was really focused at getting these core constituents out to the polls, and they did it very successfully.
And philosophically, would it be fair to say that the Republicans are, at least at this point in time, just too conservative, at least this ticket was, for the American public, that it was too conservative a ticket?
I don't know if too conservative is exactly the right way to put it, but clearly they need to fix their Hispanic problem, and that is going to be a huge problem for them going forward. It's one of the two, besides Asians, who they also got totally destroyed with last night, are the two fastest-growing communities in the U.S., they're fast-growing in swing states, especially in Nevada and Arizona, which may be a swing state at the presidential level next time around. In New Mexico is now a Democratic state. It used to be a Republican state or a swing state. Florida, it's a huge community. They need to fix that. And on top of that, they're not doing well with younger voters. And they really are trying to rely on a coalition that's older, whiter, and shrinking. Mm. And it's really that they're going to have to start looking towards the future. And a lot of Republicans were saying that to me and on TV last night, that they need to fix this. They need to get away from this. And they need to get away from the coalition that really was a successful coalition for them, but it was a short-sighted coalition in 2004 with older, whiter evangelicals. And as long as Democrats continue to do okay with whites in the Rust Belt, which they've long done pretty well with the more populist white voters there and union voters there, they're going to have a pretty strong coalition at the presidential level and probably at the Senate level.
Let's go to phone calls. Lines, a couple are open for you right now. This is your chance to just jam those lines, and let's hear from as many of you as we can. What we did yesterday in terms of voting is what we're talking about. And our guest this part of the show is Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill. 800-486-8655, the number. Christian in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. I want to go back to the president's acceptance speech last night, and a couple of words leapt out at me. But despite all our differences, most of us share certain hopes for America's future, and then blah, 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 we want our kids to grow up in a country, and et cetera. Most of us. I think that that's going to be the theme that he's going to try and work on in his second term, is to kind of split that Republican coalition, try and isolate the hard right nut of it, and kind of maybe bring some people who don't recognize this Republican Party anymore over to some kind of coalition that he can, use to exert some pressure on Congress.
Cameron.
I think that's a good point. The problem is there aren't a ton of Republican moderates left. While the House as a whole basically stayed where it was last night, The Republicans picked up a lot of seats in more conservative territory, and there were a few Republicans who were more moderate on some issues that lost last night. In Illinois, they lost 4 seats right now, and 3 of those members were 3 of the most moderate members of the GOP coalition. And it's going to be interesting to see how the Republicans react, but the Republican coalition in the House actually got probably more conservative last night. And they might have lost, it's looking, there's still a lot of seats left to be counted that are, a few hundred votes dividing, but it looks like they're probably going to lose, 6-8 seats max. But there aren't that many moderates left. And the question is whether some of the more conservative Republicans realize, look, this isn't a sustainable coalition at the national level and try and fix it, and whether Speaker Boehner and Eric Cantor make that move. And Boehner's more, I think his gut instinct is a little more moderate than Cantor's, but he's got to watch over his shoulder, because if he moves too far to the center and loses the base, then Cantor is likely to challenge him at some point for leadership of the House Republicans. So it's going to be a very interesting fight within the GOP over the next few weeks and months. And I think the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling that's looming in the spring are going to be very, very interesting and instructive fights about how Republicans are willing, whether they're willing to compromise or whether it's going to look a lot like the last 2 years. And knowing a lot of these Republicans, I think that is going to be a very ugly fight within the party as well as between them and the president. And I don't know how much is really going to change after the last 2 years.
Catherine in Madison, hi.
Hi. Well, that actually speaks directly to my question. I'm trying to figure out, given the fact that polling for quite a while now has said that the public in general that Congress has the lowest disapproval rating ever, how can we make sense of the fact that they've brought that back again, even more so apparently?
Yeah.
I know locally here in Wisconsin, it's being attributed to redistricting them. I don't know if that's part of the answer elsewhere or if there's some other explanation, but I just find that really strange, and I would love to hear somebody address it.
Yeah, I think that redistricting is spot on. You're looking at Sean Duffy in northern Wisconsin was really boosted by redistricting. That district got about 3 points more Republican, and probably, I don't know if it was the reason that he won, but it was certainly a big reason that he won when he pulled out. I mean, he ended up winning by a pretty comfortable margin anyways, but Republicans in 2010 clean Democrats' clocks at the state levels, too, and so they got to draw the maps in a lot of big swing states in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Michigan, in Florida, and they really were able to shore up their new members, their freshmen. And I think probably with the way that the national results broke last night, if it had been an even redistricting map across the country, Democrats probably would have taken control of the House.
Really?
And the Republicans were really able to protect themselves. I mean, we're talking about, they have control of a state like Pennsylvania. They have 3 times the Republican members as Democratic members. The Democrats actually lost 2 members last night in Pennsylvania while President Obama was winning the state fairly comfortably. And in Ohio, I got to double check the final numbers, but I think it's like 14-4 Republican there. In Michigan, it's a similar lopsided margin. In Florida, it's similar, although the Republicans were a little constrained by some laws there about having to draw compact districts. But they're going to have a big edge in Florida, too. And so, when members get to pick their voters and when politicians get to pick their voters and have a strong incentive to make sure that they don't lose, then it becomes very hard for people, for the party who's out of power to gain. And Republicans are really able to cement a lot of their 2010 gains just by jiggering with the lines in a lot of
states. Interesting. Cameron, thank you. You were so informative. Join us again, please.
Of course.
Thanks. Cameron Joseph, staff writer for The Hill. We thank him, Brian Bull, Chuck Kornbach for being with us to analyze what happened yesterday. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Dante Chinney of Patchwork Nation is one of our guests tomorrow. Please stay tuned. More analysis coming up on the news and on programs.
Johann Sebastian Bach spent a lot of time in Leipzig, where he wrote some great masterworks. That's just one of the stops on WPR's upcoming holiday trip to Germany. We'll also explore the Christmas markets in medieval Nuremberg, visit the Berlin Wall, and take in some classical concerts. I'm your host for the tour, Stephanie Elkins, inviting you to join me and fellow listeners in early December. There's only a handful of spots left. Find details at WPR.org/travel. Contributors to WPR include Hooper Corporation, providing electric power and mechanical construction services to commercial, industrial, renewable energy, and utility customers nationwide. Hooper Corporation, a Wisconsin company since 1913.